Listen to the children of Gaza, Amira Haas. When the Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz gave this talk in Chicago on May 5, 2019, the most recent bombing of the Gaza Strip had entered its third day. Israeli warplanes and artillery had struck more than 100 sites across Gaza, killing 23 people. At the same time, homemade rockets from Gaza struck southern Israel and killed 4 Israelis. Amira Haas is the only Jewish Israeli correspondent on Palestinian affairs who is living on the West Bank among the people she reports on. She was born in 1956 in Israel to Holocaust survivors. She spoke at the Broadway United Methodist Church in Chicago. Amira Haas.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on this Sunday sunny day, which is much less sunny for us when we know what is going on right now. Shelling of Gaza, rockets launched at Israeli communities on the other side of the border. And this makes my job today very relevant, but also much harder, because I was asked to speak in general about the children of Gaza. But when you suggested this title of children, it brought at the same time a smile on my face, because I could imagine all those children, all these Gazan children that I have known over the years, and then tremendous sadness, because first of all, I am deprived of entering Gaza. I'm not allowed, like all the other Israeli journalists. We, since 2006, we are not allowed to enter Gaza. And the journalist that I am, I need things which are very concrete in order to describe. So, you know, I don't want to tell you statistics about Palestinian children. This you can read in books. Reports of the World Bank, for example, that there are the number of children until the age of 15, that 45 or so percent of the Palestinian, of the Gazan population, are children below 15 and below. And about 60% of kids in working age, between 15 to 24 or 25, are unemployed. So all these statistics you can find. I'm not here for giving you statistics. A while ago, I had two things that happened, and you understand why I'm smiling. I got an email by someone who lives now in Amman, in Jordan. I knew him when he was a child, and he reminded me how I played with them. And then I got a note from his cousin. These two kids, Azat and Bashar, have managed to leave, and they prosper outside. They left because having stayed in Gaza would have not allowed them to ever to develop themselves. They miss Gaza. If Gaza were not a huge prison, they would have stayed in Gaza. But this is the minority. How many can arrange this solution for themselves? So I think about all the others, too, that I don't have contact with. For example, in Rafah, I remember in 2004, there was an Israeli invasion for several days and a curfew over the refugee camp in a large neighborhood, when the Israeli army demolished many houses. And kids with their families found shelter in UNRWA schools, in some schools. And I would go to the schools to collect testimonies of families and children about the Israeli army and about the demolition. One of them, I remember, and now preparing for the, I thought about him. A huge, huge bulldozer, military armored bulldozer, approached the house while the family was in or almost getting out. And over a night, that's what his mother told me, over the night, he got white hair. He was, I think, if I remember correctly, around 8 to 9 years old. Then I remember another child, a child of friends of mine in northern Gaza Strip, in Beit Hanun. The soldiers took him as a human shield when they wanted to enter houses and look for explosives or militants. And they took him as human shield. And for years he suffered from a skin rash and completely traumatized. And then I wonder about all the other children that I know that have lived through three major wars and uncounted military invasions and attacks. And now, right now, live under this fear that any moment an Israeli bomb will fall on a nearby house, not on their house, but on a nearby house. I can imagine the terrifying noise of these bombs. I mean, I heard them too. We know, according to UN figures, at least 300,000 children need some sort of psychological assistance, having been traumatized all over these years. It's hard to imagine 300,000 in a population of 2 million. But what about the parents? What about the fathers? What about the mothers? Can you really achieve anything of this psychological assistance or support or protection while the trauma in which you are, I mean, it's not post-trauma, it's a successive trauma. Whenever I have the chance to meet a Palestinian, a young Palestinian, and it is very rare going out of Gaza, I feel awe. I feel I'm full of admiration. 2 years ago, another child of my friends, he came in a group that was the first time allowed to go out of Gaza and to travel in the West Bank and to meet West Bankers, West Bank children. And they were dancing and they were playing music, those children who came from Gaza. And just 2 years earlier, they went through this war. And they were smiling and they were joking, and he told me things about Hamas with a lot of criticism, but at the same time he was joking and he was preparing for an exam. And I asked myself, where is the energy from? Where are the talents from? And I say to ourselves, because we think about Gazans in general and Gazans in particular, and children in particular, and Palestinians in general, as the victims that deserve our mercy. And I plead us to say they are wronged. It's a people being wronged for very long. But the title of victim minimizes and limits our understanding of their strength. But when I don't talk about the military attacks and the bombing and the fear of being murdered and wounded, when I don't talk about this, I talk about the prison that Gaza is. While the military situation like today is somehow political decision by both parties, both Hamas and Israeli army, the reality in which Palestinians live in Gaza, which is prison or a huge detention camp, is a totally Israeli human-made reality that is the sole responsible for the disaster in which Gazans live, and that the UN said a disaster that will reach a point in 2020, a point where Gaza will not be any more livable or habitable. The pollution of water, the pollution of overflowing of sewage, the contamination of the land, of the soil, how I cannot even imagine with what the soil of Gaza is absorbed after all the Israeli bombings. What kind of chemicals or metals have been absorbed there in the soil and in the water? Israel sprays the fields of Gazans with chemicals, with herbicide. Twice a year, these herbicides enter into Gaza, and we know that it is in order to make visibility for the Israel army. How all these things affect people and children. and the fact that children do not know what it is to go beyond 40 kilometer long, 15, 16 kilometer width of Gaza. And I think about the million children that I don't know. This policy, this Israeli policy, and it's very important to remember that it is a policy. And it started as a political measure in 1991. It is then that Israel issued a pass system very similar to that of the apartheid South Africa. Until then, Palestinians had a certain freedom of movement within the country, and they could go between Gaza and the West Bank, and from Gaza to Israel, and from West Bank to Israel, without permits. The rule was that people's right for freedom of movement is respected, including children. And by the way, many children went to Israel to work and started helping their families very early on when they were 14 and 13. They went to Israeli markets and worked there and to Israeli restaurants and washed the dishes there and contributed greatly to the economical sustainability of their families. Another admirable aspect of Palestinian children back then. But Israel, at the eve of the negotiations with the Palestinians, first in Madrid and later on in Oslo, Israel changed this policy and decided that Palestinians have to have a personal permit in order to leave each area, either the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. And this runs contrary to a promise made at Oslo negotiations that both Gaza and the West Bank are one territorial unit because they are going to constitute the future Palestinian state. And you ask me why, and I'll tell you, because if this, the Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank, was seen by the world as a basic for the peaceful solution or peaceful settlement between the two sides, and that the Palestinians accepted, fully accepted, Israel did everything possible to foil this possibility of a Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank. And the first condition for this was to disconnect Gaza from the West Bank. The second condition for this was to actually replicate or duplicate Gaza in the West Bank, to create enclaves in the West Bank, Palestinian enclaves, separated from each other, engulfed by an Israeli-controlled territory of settlements and military positions. So the reality today is that we have the enclave of Gaza and several enclaves, Palestinian enclaves, under limited Palestinian self-rule in the West Bank. It's not all the West Bank. It's only 39% of the West Bank. Areas that are disconnected from each other and that Israel can any moment shut down so that they cannot even move from one place to another, just like Gazans cannot move. It is an occupation without direct presence of soldiers, but it is an occupation that is very invasive, military occupation, very invasive, that goes into the details of people's lives, to the extent that people who are married cannot live together in the same place if one is Gazan and one is not, or that they are separated from their own children if one of the spouses is a Gazan and cannot go and live with the children in the West Bank. And the details are many. You know, it never ends. I mean, I can continue and continue. I think that the main demand has to be to lift, indeed, to lift this blockade over Gaza. And this issue is not about Egypt, about the freedom of people to go outside from Gaza and to go to Egypt. First, they have to restore their right for freedom of movement outside of Gaza, either to Israel, historical Palestine, and to the West Bank and abroad, through where it is the easiest and the closest, not Rafah. The natural ties are within the country. Israel, historical Palestine, West Bank, whatever. And this has to be restored, including, of course, the economical restrictions and other things. Otherwise, indeed, Gaza will be totally inhabitable in 2 or 3 or 5 months. Thank you.
You are listening to the Israeli journalist Amira Haas. She spoke in Chicago on May 5, 2019, on the last day of a bombing of the Gaza Strip by Israeli warplanes and artillery, while Hamas was firing homemade rockets into southern Israel. Here now is part of the question and answer session.
On behalf of Jewish people who are struggling with this, who sincerely want to take on what you're telling us, the stories, the actual suffering, but are torn because of their allegiance to Israel and their fear, their concern, reflected or unreflected, that by opening up to this, they're not being loyal to Israel. And being aware that rockets are coming in from Gaza into Israel right now, and Jewish lives are in jeopardy too.
My first answer would be, Palestinians and Israelis are not on a symmetrical stand. Palestinians have a right, and I think also an obligation, to resist Israeli foreign domination. Now, or people may argue about the forms of resistance. People have questions about them. I have my doubts. I mean, I have my analysis over Hamas' use of rockets or of militarization. I also think that many Palestinians in Gaza do not think that this is the ultimate way to win. But it's not about two symmetrical powers that fight each other. Allegiance to Israel is already a strange thing for me. This allegiance to Israel reminds me of allegiance of communists to the Soviet Union. In their refusal to know the reality, in their refusal to face the information that flows and shows that this Soviet Union is not your dreamland. I know because I come from a communist family, and I know because I've witnessed my family, my parents struggling with the information. And while I totally still adhere to basics of the socialist and radical socialist ideologies, I also refuse to see the Soviet Union or any other so-called socialist state as a model for me. And I think that the Jews have to think about this comparison and to realize that Israel is not what they have thought about that Israel is or what Israel should be. Unfortunately, with the Oslo process, which I refuse to call peace process, with the Oslo process, Israel proved to itself and to the Israelis and to the Palestinians that it is the settler colonial entity that was always charged with. A charge that it rejected for many years, but here it proves that it is. Because it was so simple to accept the generous Palestinian offer during Oslo and to establish a Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank without settlements, with Jerusalem as a capital. Israel did the opposite. Israel did everything to colonize further the West Bank, to decimate the space that is allocated to Palestinians, to fragment Palestinian community into several disconnected communities addressed as individuals and not as a people, not as a collective. It did what settler colonial entities and movements have done for 200, 300 years, and actually proved that 48 and the 30s, and it was that Zionism is a settler colonial movement. So we are in a problem. I mean, you are proving what everybody said, what people told about you, and you said that they are anti-Semites, but you are doing this. you know, like my aim would be, yes, we should respect as Jews our history. We should never tire to remind people, including Palestinians, that Zionism was not a movement of the majority. Until the late 20s, 1920s, and beginning of the 1930s, the majority of Jews opted for other solutions or other ways to evade or to escape persecution or to challenge persecution. And anti-Semitism and persecution of Jews is not a fairy tale that we tell you. It was real. It was real, but the majority of Jews preferred to remain in the diaspora and to find solutions in the diaspora. I take my parents. They saw the diaspora as their home. My mother is from Yugoslavia, my father is from Romania. These were their homes. But then, with the advent of Hitler to power in Germany and the advent of Nazism, the diaspora gave another message to the Jews. Not only that they are second or third or fourth rate citizens, not only that they are not wanted among these countries, but they are not wanted in this world. And this was a strong message. We should not belittle this. And I'm sure that if United States and Canada had opened their gates to Jewish emigration in the 30s and the 40s, not just, you know, some select celebrities like Einstein or I don't know what, or Hannah Arendt, but the whole, the masses, the proletariat, the poor people, if they had accepted them all, they wouldn't have come to Palestine. They would have been saved, many of them would have been saved, and they wouldn't have emigrated to Palestine. Okay, so Jews came, and it's at the expense of Palestinians. So if we really wanted a refuge, and if we really wanted to build a model society, first of all, we would have accepted the Palestinians back, those who were expelled or ran away or were not in the country in 1948. I know it is, today it sounds completely hypothetical, but we had several opportunities over the years to build another course, not to remain a foreign entity, foreign European entity within an Arab world. We decide to be so, and for this we have to permanently rely on the military strength, expand this military strength, and then export it to the world, and then export it to murderous regimes all over the world for profit. So this is Israel. And I don't think that this is something that I would, you know, that I feel solidarity with this, the need of Jews to have allegiance to this kind of Israel.
We are told that Israel today is genocidal, murderous, and we're also told that today in Israel, the people are more religious than they ever have been in the past.
From my observation and analysis over the last 30 years, I allow myself to say that the term genocidal, when it comes to Israeli policies, is not reflecting the reality. It reflects maybe a political position of people and tendencies, and I don't like to give scores or to create hierarchy in suffering. The aim of Israeli policies is not genocide. I don't know if the aim of the people who, or the movements which established the America and United States, if the aim was genocidal, but the result was genocidal. But the Palestinians have not been and are not decimated the way the indigenous people here were decimated. So to say genocide about Israeli policies is inaccurate. Now, I mean, there has been created some sort of hierarchy, and very much to the blame of Israel, the way it manipulates and merchandises the Holocaust, that puts things in suffering and atrocities in hierarchy, And if you don't reach the top, what was claimed to be the top of the German Nazi industry of murder, then okay, all the rest is okay. Nonsense, of course not. Personally, as a child of survivors, I come to think very often, aren't 300, 400 years of slavery not much worse Holocaust than what my people has been through? It was, you know, it was for 5 years, 6 years, and it ended. The whole world was against, I mean, the many countries joined in and fought against the Nazi Germany. But with American African slaves, how long it took, and with all the remnants still today. So I'm asking myself, without being like the genocide of the Jews in Europe, I often feel that this is, again, I don't like to make hierarchies, but I think that that also relates to many more people in so many centuries. I say it because we have to be accurate about the definitions and the descriptions we give. The purpose of Israeli policies is to fragment Palestinian society, is to dissuade it from or block its demands for freedom, for liberation, for the right of return, for a right of self-determination. This is the Israeli aim. It is not about murdering the entire Palestinian people. And you see, Gaza 20 years ago was around 1,200,000 people. It's 2 million today, with all the wars and everything. So the means, of course, bring realities to unbearable levels. And unbearable doesn't have to be a concentration camp like Auschwitz or Bergen-Belsen, where my mother was. No. Unbearable is that a child cannot travel and cannot have clean water and cannot play and cannot study. This is unbearable. Why do we have to put as a standard the worst periods in human history, and certainly not only the worst periods in Europe?
You heard Listen to the Children of Gaza by Amira Haas. She's a columnist for the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz for over 30 years. She's the author of Reporting from Ramallah, An Israeli Journalist in an Occupied Land, and Drinking the Sea at Gaza. Amira Haas spoke at the Broadway United Methodist Church in Chicago on May 5, 2019. You heard excerpts from a recording produced by Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio and posted online at Radio for All. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glöden. Thank you for listening.